Hi, I'm Leigh Don Hines, and this is How to Fall Apart with the Irish Cancer Society. Every October, the ICS would typically hold coffee mornings around the country in order to raise funds and awareness for breast cancer, but this year that is not possible. It means that we need to find other ways of supporting the absolutely vital work that the Society does to ensure breast cancer patients and their families have access to support services. You can donate online to both help support breast cancer patients and back vital research. My guest today is Evelyn O'Rourke. 2 days after she discovered she was pregnant with her second child, 6 months after the birth of her first son, journalist Evelyn was diagnosed with breast cancer. She had to undergo chemotherapy while pregnant. We talked about going through treatment whilst expecting, the emotions that come with a cancer diagnosis, and living with anxiety in the aftermath. I suppose the first thing is, it was 2010.
Yes.
And you were pregnant with your second boy.
Yes.
Your first was 6 months old.
Yes.
You had your hands full
in
as
style.
Well. Yeah. And 2 days after you found out you were pregnant, you were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how that unfolded?
I can indeed. So first of all, thank you for having me here.
No,
what happened was life was swimming along beautifully, and we had Oisin, our first baby, in December 2010. And I was working the Gerry Ryan Show at the time. I'd been Gerry's reporter for 8 years.
Yeah.
And I'd obviously left the show to go on maternity leave, and I was having a ball with my baby. And then Gerry died very suddenly, as we all know, on April 30th, which is actually our wedding anniversary. So that was the first tremor in my life. And then at that time, so basically I had something on my breast.
Yeah.
And it was an unusual presentation. And one of the reasons I like to speak to women about this is to kind of notify them about that, because it wasn't a lump. It was like a spot that a teenager would have on their neck.
Okay.
Like kind of angry looking acne.
Okay.
So it was outwards. It was, you know, very near the nipple. So it wasn't the traditional kind of lump.
Yeah.
Now, I've been very lucky in that there's no real history of breast cancer in my family. So it's not something that was kind of on my radar at all. So it was there and was kind of nagging me. And then Gerry died and I was very caught up with all that. That was very difficult. That was very traumatic. My husband, John, was the head of 2FM at the time.
Okay.
So it really was just, it was every area
affected
of our lives.
Of yeah.
And we had this little baby and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of was ignoring it for a week or two, and then I just thought, this thing is still there. So I went to the doctor and I had decided myself, because I'm a genius, that it was a cyst. And I don't even know what a cyst is, but I was like, it's going to be a cyst. And she said, I'm going to give you an antibiotic and I'm going to make an appointment for you in the breast clinic with the breast surgeon in Vincent's. And we're going to give it a week. And if it comes down, then we know it's an infection and we're not in trouble. But if it doesn't, let's have that appointment set up.
Okay.
And that was the absolute first wobble in terms of the breast cancer thing, because it had never been mentioned to me before and it certainly not dawned on me at all.
Okay.
So I spent the week staring at it, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many women will kind of recognise that moment. And poor John, I used to be like, it's gone down. I'd say it's gone down. Is that smaller?
Yeah.
That's smaller. That has shrunk. You can hardly see it. That's huge. It's bigger. You know, it was ludicrous. This ridiculous week of monitoring this thing. So we went into Vincent's. We decided to go ahead of the appointment and went into my lovely surgeon, Dennis Evoy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was myself and John and the baby. And, you know, Kitty, Dennis's wife, runs ran the surgery at the time. And she was minding Oisin out the front. And like, when I think back, we were so naive. You know, we ambled in as if we were nearly having a picnic or something.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't think until there's
not anything. At all. Mm-hmm. No. And things had been lovely. And then Gerry, and, you know, it was just a really weird kind of time. So that whole time is just a cloud of confusion, actually, for me when I think back to those months. But we talked to Dennis and he said, look, we're going to start having a look at this. You just should have nothing there. There should just be nothing at all on your breast other than, you know, your nipple. And if there's something there, you need to investigate. So I said, fine. So we started that. I was 37 at the time. So I was considered obviously very young to get it. So we went through a few tests or whatever. And then it was the June bank holiday Monday. And I was due in on the Friday for results. And because you've many female audience to this, I'll go ahead and say I had some sort of thrush. And I was taking the Caniston pessary. And it kept saying, make sure you're not pregnant. And by the third time the instruction leaflet, I was like, I'm not pregnant, but it was kind of like it was screaming at me.
Yeah.
I thought, I better take a bloody test to prove that I'm not, so I can get on with taking this pessary and get on with clearing all that up. This is a really charming conversation. And I
don't think anything you say there will have shocked anyone.
Yeah, John was hilarious about it, because John was in the bedroom with Oisin. And he said, I was in the bathroom and I was banging around, making loads of noise and being quite grumpy, I'd say, about this whole situation. And he said, suddenly went really quiet. And I'd gone into him and said, I have to take this bloody pregnancy test. And he said, he just went, why is she so quiet? And it was like you know, the stick springs into action, yeah, like a comedy scene. It was like, I'm here. Yeah. I'm a baby. It was beautiful, but like absolutely shocking, yeah, and beautiful. But just, I was so stunned. I went into John. I was like, look at this. So we were obviously delighted, mm-hmm, and over the moon and all that. But we thought, I thought I'd better ring the breast care nurse and just let her know. So I rang Claire, mm, and I said, hi Claire, I know I'm coming in Friday, just to let you know, a little bit of news, I'm pregnant. I presume that won't affect anything. Hung up the phone and went off to the park.
Okay.
Little realising that this was going to be seismic in terms of them.
Yeah.
So we arrived in on Friday. I was in such super excited form about, mm, our new baby, mm, and Ushin was great and everything. This was all going to be fine. John was much more worried than I was.
Really?
Yeah, very, very concerned. And we went in, we met Dennis and Claire, and Dennis brought us down to the room. Mm. And it was a Friday. And can I just say, any Friday that you're not in Vincent's Hospital getting results is a good Friday.
Yeah.
I often think on Fridays,
yeah,
there's somebody whose little world is being, you, yeah, know, shattered.
Right. Yeah.
And he just said, we have a problem. And the biopsy had come back to say that it was positive and that there was a problem. And John, he hates this bit, he collapsed.
Oh, God.
Yeah. He fainted beside me.
Oh, God, the poor, mm, thing.
Mm.
He was obviously so worked up and, yeah, tense that when it hit him.
And I think I was being such a kind of Egypt. He was nearly going the other way.
Yeah, yeah.
So we kind of slagged about that, like, you know, it's actually about me, not you. But that was really shocking because, yeah, he's an absolute rock, and to see, yeah, him disintegrate like that and have that physical reaction. But apparently it's not uncommon.
Really?
And it's something here again for men. What can they do? They're used to fixing things. They, yeah, like to fix things. Yeah. And suddenly they're handed this news.
Yeah.
And again, thankfully, nobody in our family had really gone through cancer, so it wasn't a world we knew particularly.
Mm.
So then Dennis said to me, look, we're going to do a quick mammogram.
Mm.
And I said, fine, because I hadn't done a mammogram. And there's, okay, a reason they don't really do mammograms under 50, because your breast tissue just doesn't, it doesn't work well for it. But we went ahead and did it, and that was clear. Mm. You know, again, I was, mm, so kind of young, under 40 at the time. Mm. So he sent us home to think about things, and we were to come back in on the Tuesday, and we just spent the weekend reeling, really. And,
yeah,
Bloom was on in Phoenix Park, and it was a beautiful weekend, and we walked from Dundrum to Phoenix Park.
Did you?
Yeah, we just walked and walked and walked. It's like I couldn't stop walking.
Yeah.
I had to keep moving, I had to keep moving, and we talked and we talked and walked.
Did you tell family or anything was going on at that point?
Yes, we had told my sister. Mm-hmm. And we had told John's parents, who had been minding us, she actually on the Friday.
Okay.
And my sister were really, really close.
Mm.
And on the Friday, she knew we were in Dennis, and she kept ringing me, and my phone was off.
Mm.
And my phone, I'm not great on my phone, but John's amazing.
Okay.
And John wasn't answering his phone. So she got into her car and drove down to Vincent's, and she was trying to find us, and we were trying to find her. And we came back up to the house, and she kind of knew as soon as she opened the door. So it was really, really shocking. I got her to tell my mum, though, because I was slightly embarrassed for the pregnancy so soon after having had a baby. It's been stupid. It's kind of, can you tell her? But it was the double whammy news. It, yeah, was just ludicrous.
Yeah. I mean, telling ludicrous. Your mum is particularly hard, I think.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah, it is.
Can be.
Yeah, so that's why I gave her to Kim. To,
yeah, it's fair.
And she'd do that very elegantly.
Yeah.
So I decided again in my genius wisdom that I would go ahead. I planned all this. I was going to go ahead and have surgery, and, yeah, then I was going to my chemo and radiotherapy after I'd had the baby.
Okay.
That was quite clever, wasn't it? So I arrived in on Tuesday, and I was very agitated when we got in. And again, it's something I'm a real advocate for this.
Mm.
We were brought into this bloody room with the nice tissues that you can't bear. Because, you know, it's serious. You know, I love, mm, when they're quite rude to you in the car park because then they've no interest in you. That's great. The, yeah, ruder staff are to you, the better.
Yeah.
And I just said to Dennis, I need to walk. And he said, okay. And we walked all around the grounds of Vincent's. He was so sweet to me. And he used to slag and go, please don't tell anyone else I did this because I don't want to spend my days walking around Vincent's grounds. Yeah, I just babbled okay. on the baby and the chemo and all this. And he was, yeah, like, look, we're going to take our time to think about this for a few days. But yes, you do need to do chemo and you need to do it quickly.
Had you interviewed many women who had breast cancer? Like, did you have a sense of how the treatment?
Not really.
Okay.
I remember saying to Dennis, I think the reason John collapsed actually was when he told me, I said to him, is this terminal?
Okay. Which,
like, I'm so embarrassed about that.
No, but that's what where your mind goes when somebody says cancer.
He said, look, we have to get on treatment.
Mm.
So John Crown was going to be my oncologist.
Yes.
And we just had a lot of fretting. It was very stressful. It was, yeah, very difficult.
Yeah.
And the one thing that was clear for me all along was I just really wanted this baby.
Yeah.
So John's concern was that there'd be any compromise in my care because I was pregnant. He was like, you're here, Ushin's here. Let's focus on the people.
Yeah. No. Okay. Okay.
Who are here and healthy, and what can we do to, okay, make sure that this is all really good. And he was so excited about the baby as well, though, because it was so unexpected.
Mm.
So he was just torn in every direction. Anyway, yeah. We went into John Crown, who, as you know, is the most
amazing,
kind of confident,
yes,
inspiring person. And he said, look, don't, we can do this. And he said, I've done this for years. Okay. I have given chemo to women who are pregnant.
Okay.
And we've had very safe outcomes, very good outcomes. And I'm happy to kind of press on with this. Mm. And he was incredibly reassuring, and we went home and we thought about it. And the next thing was, it was a very odd story in the Sunday Tribune, and a few papers picked up. I got a phone call actually one evening from a journalist saying, we've heard a very odd story that you are pregnant and dealing with breast cancer. And I went, right, okay. So the story kind of got out there, and I was there in some of the Sundays. And okay. I suppose Jerry's death had put a lot of focus on our team, and there was kind of a lot of interest around us. And I'd done Jerry's tribute program and all that. And the next one's got an email out of the blue from a woman who was a Jerry Rancho listener.
Yes.
And said, I've read your story, and I am putting two and two together, because I hadn't said we were going to do chemotherapy through the pregnancy.
Okay.
But she said, I am guessing that you're going to do chemotherapy now.
Yeah.
And you are probably really freaked out about that, but I did this 9 years ago. Ring me.
That was amazing.
That was amazing.
Yeah. Bridget Mulqueen.
Yeah, we're still in touch.
Are you?
Yeah, yeah. And she was great. So I rang her, and I went home and I rang her, and I said hi, and she said hi. And I said, I'm Evelyn, and you got in touch. And she said, yeah. And the next one was her, this really grumpy 9-year-old from background. She went, Mom, I don't want to have a shower. And she went, can you give me a minute? I said, of course I can. And she said, Jack, go have your shower. And I don't want to have a shower. And I went, is that him? And she said, yes.
Aww.
And I went, great, he's the perfect 9-year-old. Yeah, a bit grumpy, and you know, this is real, this is gorgeous, this is fabulous. And she was amazing. She just kind of took me by the hand and led me through the whole thing. This is what's going to happen. She really, the combination of her and John Crown, my own instinct as a mum to be, just powered us through, really. And we went back to John Crown and said, yeah, let's do this. So you the placenta, as we know, is amazing. So the deal is you have to wait till your second trimester. And that's what we did.
How did you handle the nerves up until then?
Well, I did my surgery first. That got very complicated because I got an infection into my nodes, and we couldn't do antibiotics because of the baby. So I ended up on this crazy temperature, and we ended up, you know, we're going to cut the infection out. I always think it sounds very kind of First World War or something.
Yes.
Like the field hospital. Yeah. At the trenches. No, remove the infection. So that was very scary.
Yeah.
But thankfully I recovered from that. Yeah. And then we went for the scan, and the baby was doing brilliantly.
Okay.
The baby did brilliantly in every scan. He just overperformed every time. And then I started my chemo in the middle of August.
So can you tell me what that felt like?
Yeah, going it was horrendous.
Yeah.
You have to remember, I'd just been pregnant with Usheen.
Yeah.
And I'd had this kind of picture perfect pregnancy with Usheen. And I'd done my antenatal yoga, and I'd done my no eating prawns, and, you know, all this stuff that kind of pregnant women, a bit harsh now at this point, I think, that we put on ourselves. But there you go. I'd done it all.
Yeah.
I'd had this really perfect pregnancy. And within months, I was suddenly having to junk all that.
Hmm.
And going from, oh, I don't take Disprin, to, but I walk into an oncology ward and I'll pump chemotherapy into my veins. How do you square that as a mother? Like, how do you say this is a correct decision? I think the morning walking into the chemo ward, the first morning, was probably the darkest morning of all. Because I was clearly pregnant at that stage, because second trimester, and, you know, a bit bigger maybe the second time as well. And it was such an unknown, and everybody was willing you so well, but it was your arm that you were handing over, and they were struggling to get a vein. And I remember to soak my arm in the cold water to get a vein. And I remember thinking, how is there life in my tummy and cancer in my breast, and they're right beside each other? This makes no sense to me. Even like in a real estate way, they're they're right beside each other. It's not even in my leg. Like, the baby's nearly touching my breast, and yet the baby's doing great, but there's cancer here. Or at that point, with surgery, obviously the cancer was gone, but, you know, the chemo bit was to make sure that was all sorted. So that was extraordinarily difficult. And it was awful.
At what point did you start writing the letters that turned into the book, Dear Ross?
I wrote letters very early on. I kept apologising to Usheen. What I found is I kept going into him and saying, I'm so sorry, this isn't the first year you're supposed to have.
Of course.
Because he was, what, 8, 9 months at that point. And I remember going into him, and I just spent hours just saying, I'm so sorry, this, you should be having this perfect first year, and you know, your mummy is sick and this isn't what it's mm-hmm. supposed to be. And I got very clear memories of being in Vincent's Hospital and my mother-in-law who died recently. And I love her, Margaret. Yeah, loved her. She was in at my sister and they were trying to collapse the buggy and it was really hard and it was kind of hysterically funny. And Oisin was just sitting on my lap in Vincent's and this was his summer, you know, and he just spent the summer being passed around to all these people who adore him. Mm. So it kind of started as a letter to him and then it was a letter to Ross because I didn't know whether Ross was boy or girl. We decided to keep that as a little surprise. And then I finished chemotherapy in November. And obviously you can't do radiotherapy. I have met one or two crisis cases where people have done radiotherapy in pregnancy, but it's obviously really, really difficult decision. So in my case, we had decided to wait. Mm. So we went ahead. He was born maybe 2 weeks early.
And you said in one interview, you described it as for the 9 months of the pregnancy, it was about outsourcing your life.
Yes.
You mentioned some of your support network there. So you almost looked around you.
Yeah.
They're good for this. And can you tell me a little bit about that? Because it's hard to delegate, isn't it?
I think it's very hard to delegate. I got very crafty very quickly. Mm. My mum lives next door, Peggy, and she was great at just taking Oisin off and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when Ross came, she used to take him at night and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was, she'd sweep in and just give me the baby and she'd just disappear off.
Brilliant.
And the odd time he's sitting there going, please let her come in, I'm really tired. I'd be waiting for the door. She's a great social life. You'd be waiting for her to come home from the concert hall or something. And then you'd hear the key in the door. My sister and I are really close.
Yeah.
And Kim is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
So I went, right, she'll be brilliant for all that very heavy emotional support.
Okay.
So she used to come to chemotherapy with me.
Yeah.
And the room was tiny. It was the old Vincent's private, not the new building. I was one of the last patients in the old building.
Mm.
And there was this little tiny stool, and they gave her a special dispensation because of my situation. And she used to sit tottering on the stool for hours.
Really?
Just going, blah, blah, Kate Middleton's fringe, blah, blah, blah. So I was really smart at going, John is really good at that bit. John's parents are really good at this bit. Da, da, da. And I got quite ruthless about it. And I had to be very honest very quickly about my own capacity and go, nope, that's not going to work. I can't do that. I can't do that. So, yes, I got very clever. I also realized I needed company every day at some point.
Yes.
And I was really honest about that. So I used to book people in for lunch and they had to bring the lunch.
Mm.
And
brilliant.
I used to get a lot
that
of slagging about
it. Brilliant idea.
Yeah. But you got invited, plus you had to feed me. It was
fair enough.
Pretty poxy invitation, to be honest. And I love coleslaw, so I used to get a lot of slagging about being a culture, my coleslaw, even though I'm from Dublin. So I was just very open.
Yeah.
One of the things I find now is a lot of people get in touch with me on behalf of their sister or their friend.
Okay.
And they ring me and I know the cancer phone call. I know from the way they make it. They're like, hi, have you got a minute? And I'm going, here it goes.
Mm.
And they'll say X has been diagnosed. And the person, my friend, will be really upset.
Mm.
And I'll say, absolutely give your sister or sister-in-law whatever my number. And they never ring.
Really?
Never, ever,
really?
ever ring. I find it astonishing. I find it scary how people lock down. And maybe I'm a talker and it doesn't bother me. And maybe we were in such a bad, tricky situation. We just had to ask for help.
Mm.
But I find that really intriguing. I find it really, really intriguing.
And do you think it's that they just get so overwhelmed they can't reach out? Or do you think it's an inability to say, I need help here?
I think it's a privacy thing that's gone to the extreme, in that I think we all like to be very much in control of our lives.
Yeah.
And we can lead quite private lives now. Like, it's unusual for me to live next door to my mother, for example, in Dublin. You know, so you can, in the burbs, you can, people all around you don't know you.
Mm.
And I think it's a control thing. I think it's a dignity thing, which is important.
Mm.
I think everything's out of control when you're given a diagnosis. So the little things you can control are who knows and how you manage it.
Yeah.
I've met people the odd time when they have maybe ventured to go for a coffee and they're like, yeah, no, it's absolutely fine. It's absolutely fine. Yeah, it's fine. No, we're totally fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fine. There was a pal last week who texted me out of the blue and said, she's been diagnosed, and I said, talk anytime. Yeah, absolutely, I will, yeah.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything since.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think kind of educated, smart women put a huge amount of burdens on themselves to overachieve.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I think this is slightly part of it.
Mm. That's why I think your model of the outsourcing my life is just genius.
But it was desperate.
So it was brilliant.
It was out of desperation as well.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, we had a small baby.
Yeah.
I mean, John was in Vincent's Hospital washing bottles out. Like,
it was
using the little kettle. Like, it was very, we were up against it.
Yeah.
You know, our back was up against the wall, really, to kind of marshal this little unit through this trauma, you know.
Can we talk about some of the, how you kind of cope with some of the emotions? So the scene in your book where you describe the black wolf of fear returns to you. I think you're in the middle of treatment and you're at home alone and you call your brother.
Yes. Everybody loves that sequence. He loves that sequence. Yeah.
There is something incredibly moving about it.
There's something very moving about it because I know why it's moving. Now, I kept ringing people when I was desperate for company and I just wasn't good on my own. And poor Kim had like spent most of her life in my house and was like, I was having a really bad day and I remember thinking, I have to give her a day off. Like, it can't always be her. And Cullum's lovely, my younger brother, and he's a real Mr. Fix-It. And he's very smooth, Cullum, like, and he likes a nice suit and a nice car and, you know, he's very sharp.
And he's young. He's a younger brother.
Okay, yeah. So he's to murder each other growing up. And I just thought, I need him now. And I rang him and I said, hi. And he said, hi. I didn't even ask him where he was. I said, I need you now because if you don't come shortly, I'm going to throw myself out the window. This is how stressed I feel. And he went, give me like 20 minutes. I have no idea where he was. I've actually never asked him. And next thing, he arrived up in his beautiful suit. And I was in the bed and I was sobbing and he just kicked off his beautiful shoes and he hopped into the bed beside me to take his suit jacket off or anything and just grabbed me and lay there. I have no idea. He was in the middle of any appointment. I don't know what
it's he was just doing. Somebody answering your call like that is just incredibly moving without querying it or anything. Your husband, you talked at the start and he said something about we can do everything, just not self-pity, which was a really good kind of approach. He, tell me how that worked.
Well, kind of like, I mean, a dose of self-pity, to be honest. Yeah. He got this thing that if we were going to start a whole new home, we were gone. We were sunk because it was so crap.
That's, yeah. Yeah, I get that.
And he was like, just disappear down that. But we have each other. We have Oisin. We have family. Like, everything bar this is great. Mm-hmm. So let's keep focusing on the great. And there was a time frame. Like, having the baby was a natural clock of 9 months. And then they said, right, once you have the baby, then we'll do radiotherapy. And then, you know, you're kind of finished next summer. So you kept saying, it's just this crap year.
Yeah.
And I'm not listening to you moaning, growing up in the bed, because I think his feeling was, if we start that, this will never end.
Okay.
So we just have to be really practical.
Yeah, it's the practicality of it that I think.
Well, he's incredibly practical.
And he said to you, imagine the kids. He painted a lovely kind of image. Mm. Imagine them in Kerry.
Yeah. We go to Kerry every year. My mum is from Ballybunion, actually, but we go to the Ring of Kerry, which annoys her a lot because it's a beautiful beach of Ballybunion. Why is that good enough for us? And we've been going since I was 7. And we go with a big group of families and it's just a real rite of passage for me. And I kind of get recalibrated there. I absolutely love it. And he used to say to me, think of the children in shorties, you know, the little wetsuits. Think of them fighting on a rug over sandwiches on the beach in Kerry. And that's a very palpable, real image for me because that's what I would have done. And that was our image. We would be in the middle of some traumatic moment in chemotherapy or something. And you go, think of the beach, think of the children on the beach. And years to come, think of the children. And every year when they're there now, like, I have a little moment where I look at them as they are killing each other with their wetsuits and I'm giving out to them. And I go, hang on, remember this moment. But my advice to people is to have that, to have a very strong image of something. And that's your peace. That's your, you know, your tranquil spot. That's what you're aiming for. That's where you're going through this crap to get to that moment. And I think that's a very powerful, thing to do for yourself.
Can I ask you about the physicality of it? Like you described one scene where you're, you know, looking in the mirror and you're heavily pregnant, but you're also obviously, your hair, you've lost your hair, eyebrows, that kind of thing. Was that a thing to deal with, a big thing to deal with?
I think the physical side of being pregnant is tricky the first time because it's gorgeous and fabulous and you're not supposed to complain, but it is kind of shocking, you know. Doing it again for the second time so quickly, but, you know, without nice hair and out, the advantages you get from a pregnancy where you're, you know, blooming and all these wonderful things was very tough.
Yeah.
So rocking the bald pregnancy look is not good. It didn't bother me sometimes. I had an excellent wig. I remember Oisin's first birthday, I would have been right in the middle of chemo, coming to the end of chemo actually. We have photographs of Oisin's first birthday and I'm bright red from the steroids and I've got the wig on and I find those photographs desperately sad because we're smiling and trying to do our best. It was his first birthday party. And then there were other times it didn't bother me. And then talk in the book as well about a moment where I remember being in the chemotherapy ward and I got quite used to it at this point. And it's your reality. You kind of forget about it. And I remember being outside queuing for the loo and these two women came out and I suddenly saw myself through their eyes because they stopped and they looked at me and I could see them going, she's wearing that weird turban thing. And then they could see the tummy, you know, and she's heavily pregnant. And you could see the realization dawning on their faces. Oh my God, this girl is undergoing chemotherapy while pregnant. And that was really upsetting, actually, because you're fine. And then you see yourself with someone else's eyes and you go, this is actually dire.
Yeah.
This is just not good. You know, and I've laughed before about it, but you never want to be the worst case in the chemo ward. Like, you don't want people in chemo ward feeling sorry for you. And that's what it was at that moment. So there's little sharp moments that were very difficult and very daunting and awful. Mm. Really shitty moments of just, this is just awful. This is too much for you, a young couple with their baby to have to deal with and manage. And it was just really mean and nasty.
Had you finished the chemo when he was at the when he was born?
Yeah. So I finished my sixth bite of chemo at the end of November.
Okay.
And then we had a little rest. And then I think, I'm trying to remember, I think his official due date was Valentine's Day, actually.
Okay.
But we went about 2 weeks early. So he was February the 2nd. And that was an elective section. So it was all very kind of calm and everything.
How did that feel when he came out?
Amazing, because I was exhausted of being in charge of him.
Yeah.
All by myself. Okay. I just constantly being responsible for this baby. I really wanted, I'd made so many big decisions.
Yeah.
I just wanted the relief of handing a baby over to someone else and just like sitting back for a minute going, oh God, it's not me in charge.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I wanted him to be well.
Yeah.
And I wanted him to be healthy and I wanted it to have been the right decision. And I always had this thing that whatever happened to Ross, I was going to have to look him in the eye and say, I did chemo throughout the pregnancy.
Yeah.
And he was born, and within a minute, the paediatrician, there was a huge team around.
Yeah.
It was all very high and intense emotion. Yeah. And the paediatrician took him off and came back and said, he's perfect.
Really? They were able to say that quickly?
He's perfect. And I went, okay, let's bring him home.
That must have been amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Did you have a moment, like you described there, kind of almost holding it all together very intensely for months? Mm. Was there a moment when you crashed in the aftermath, or how did it kind of unfold that?
Yeah, I had, I was in the hospital for 5 days because obviously with an elective section, you're in for 5 days. So I came home, I think it was day 7, which would be the day the hormones would be coming in anyway. And I woke up and I felt like I was at the bottom of a barrel. It was horrendous. It's the closest I've experienced of a sharp jolt of depression. You know, I've been kind of very lucky in my mental health. Thankfully, I've been able to kind of cope quite well over the years. This was, I just felt absolutely horrendous. My mom was there and John was there and I just was sobbing and I just was in a really bad way. And we just rang ARC.
Yeah, that's when you rang.
And I just arrived at their doorstep about an hour later. John was out in the car with the children. And I just arrived at their door and this woman answered the door and I said, hi. And she said, hi, come on in. And I'd got my story ready and she didn't ask me my story. She said, come in, which is, like I always say, it's like the real pure Kate Milofolta. Come on in. We've no idea who you are. We've no idea who you are. We don't know why you're here, but you've got, obviously you look like somebody's been through treatment. And I arrived in and I sat down and she said, so how are things? And I said, I'm in the middle of treatment and I've just had a baby. And she said, where's the baby? And I said, he's out in the car. And she said, how old is the baby? And I said, oh, like 7 days. And she said, there's a 7-day-old baby out in the car. And I was, oh yeah, I had a cup of tea at this point. And I went, oh no, is it my husband? She was here. I was laughing. She's pressing the red panic button over the table. She hadn't been trained for that. And ARC were extraordinary to me. Amazing. I sat there for about 1.5 hours just blabbing. They fed me biscuits and tea. And then I think John came in for a while with the children, can't even remember. And then I set up counselling through them.
Did you? Okay, so you went on an ongoing basis.
Well, I'm not superhuman and I'm bright enough to know that very bright and smart people have thought they can handle things when they can't.
Yeah.
And I knew we'd been through an extraordinary situation and I knew I needed somebody to kind of nearly sign off on me that.
Yeah,
cause I think you handled it really well. And they kept saying you're handling it really well. And I thought, well, am I? Or am I just very good at pretending to handle this very well? And I was aware that I was on my own at times with two very small children and I was going to be sleep deprived. And it's tough on any mother in the best of circumstances. I was going to be doing this while doing my therapy and, you know, with all the love and support in the world. I just needed to know, to be brutally honest with you, that I was safe.
Yeah.
That my mood was safe. My mood range, my mental, my emotional range was okay. And that I was going to be okay managing the two small children and myself in the middle of all this kind of I mean, for 6 weeks after Ross was born, I was up in Beacon every day doing radiotherapy.
Yeah, I mean, did that feel like an exhausting hill to have to climb after what you'd been through, or how?
It felt like a little spa break, which is really tragic.
Okay.
That's how crap things were, that was actually, you know, nearly a little break. I used to go up into, there's a lovely Dunn's in Beacon.
Yeah.
And I used to go next door. I mean, radiotherapy, there's no comparison between chemotherapy and radiotherapy. Radiotherapy is a pain because it's every day. But I meet women now who are doing far fewer doses. I meet women now who don't do chemotherapy at all. It's extraordinary. And brilliant, absolutely brilliant, all about the OR number. So in a way, radiotherapy is a break. It was more the relentlessness of it. And Ross got a little bit sick in the middle of it and he was in crumbling for a week and that was all very tricky.
God, okay.
Yeah, but radiotherapy is very manageable, I found. And the Beacon was very close to the house, so it wasn't a big kind of trek. It was just, it was all relentless.
Can I ask how you and John managed in that situation? How you kind of, you know, did you pass it back and forth? I'm having a breakdown now you're having one. Or how did you?
Over to you. Not really. We're great friends.
Okay.
And we're very honest about each other. Like, he knows I'm a bit crap at stuff and I know he's a bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, we kind of very much have each other's back in terms of that.
Yeah.
And my mum's got a very sweet image where she said she was looking out her window one day because saying she lives next door to me. And we were going over to Dundrum Town Centre. We're very near Dundrum Town Centre. And we had the ridiculous double buggy and I'd say it was about, I don't know, middle of March. So Ross was, what, 6 weeks old. And I said, she was looking out and myself and John were just chatting. I said, she just stood there watching us going, they look like a normal couple. Like, nobody would know. We were like, bleep, 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 you know. I don't know. It's a very sweet thing to say, but I just, it never, it just felt like he was always there and got it. And I never, just us, Usheen and Ross being clean in a clean kind of, romper suit, or what you call them, baby girl, was like, God, you're amazing you did that, you know. There was no other level of it. And fundamentally, and I think this is the big thing, like, I was really tested. I love my life. I've loved my family. I love him. I love the children. I just wanted more of it. You know, and I think that's given me huge confidence in later years, in that I think many of us haven't kind of been tested and kind of think, maybe am I supposed to be in Hawaii selling surfboards? I had that test and no, I don't. I just want to be on the beach in Kerry with the kids, or knocking around the house with the kids and John, and I'm perfectly happy with that.
Just lastly, in the months after when it was all over, was there anxiety that it would come back, or how did that?
It's funny. I was talking about this with somebody else the other day. I got very consumed with it recurring, but I somehow decided this was a big secret that I couldn't tell anybody that I was worried it would recur. Which is barking. Of course you're worried it would recur. I don't know why. I think it's because it wasn't in my family. So just, I didn't know what to expect. And I think people were like, thank God it's done. And we got her through it. And she's fine. And the baby's fine. And it's all fine. And I used to carry it around like a very dark secret.
Like you didn't want to be a burden to them by saying, well, it's actually not over.
I presume it was that. I just, and then I went for counselling. And eventually I kind of said one day to her, I'm really worried it's going to come back. She went, but like, of course you are. And that was like, why do you go for counselling? Like, the burden lifted. I remember, like, I had a few panic attacks. I remember one day thinking I had bruises on my legs and going down to my GP and literally dropping my trousers, literally out of panic. I went, what are these? Why are there bruises on my leg? And he was like, well, can you pull up your jeans? And he pointed out where the double buggy was, that where the wheels were. I was bashing my leg constantly off that. But that's how panicky it could get. And I will always be on low level alert.
Will you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And are there things that you have done over the years that have helped with anxiety in that sense? Or is it more a passing of time? That
I do very well. I'm on tamoxifen, which I tolerate very well. And lots of people don't. I'm blessed that I do. And I find that helps enormously. It feels like a little bit of a shield. I find great comfort in taking tamoxifen. Yeah, it's a hormonal balancing drug. They used to give it to you 5 years. I'm on it now, 9 years now. And it looks like I'll stay on it for the moment. But I'm doing really well on it. It's a daily tablet. And I find that hugely comforting. And Janice Walsh is my consultant now, and I do bloods and a mammogram, annual mammogram with her, and we have a great relationship. So I'm in touch all the time. So the odd time I've had a panic attack, I can ring her and she like come in, and I have that absolutely brilliant support network, and I've got very involved Cancer Trials Ireland. I'm on their board. I'm very passionate about trials. And I've a huge network through that, and I've been on their board now for 7 years, and I do everything I can to raise awareness. I think trials and research is absolutely the key. To give the doctor options when you're sitting there, we need to do trials, we need to invest in them, and we take it really seriously, and we need to properly support the oncologists who are trying to develop and bring these trials on board so that Irish patients have access to the best that's out there.
Just lastly, Evan, if somebody's listening to this and they were at the start of it and it felt incredibly daunting, they were in that like that first weekend you described, is there one thing you would say to them that might help them at that point?
I think for me, it was the bite-sized thing, it was the 5 minutes thing. It was stop overthinking this, just get through the next 5 minutes. You can do anything for 5 minutes. And you just say to yourself, right, it's 20 past two. Oh my God, my head. Stop, get to 25 past two. Just don't think about it. What's your next job? Wash the dishes, go do that. You know, stop overthinking it. It'll all unfold. They've done this a million times. They know what they're doing. Just hand yourself over to the best medical team and just be kind to yourself and be gentle to yourself and break it all up into 5 minutes.
Evelyn, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Every cancer story is unique, but hopefully the interviews for this series will prove that there are threads of commonality that can be pulled from each, which can provide support. I hope that this episode has brought you some level of comfort if you are experiencing or know someone who's experiencing breast cancer. If you've been affected by any of the issues we've discussed on this podcast, you can contact the Irish Cancer Society Cancer Support Line on 1800 200 700 or visit cancer.ie. You can donate online at cancer.ie to both help support breast cancer patients and back vital research. This series is in conjunction with the Irish Cancer Society as part of this year's Cups Against Breast Cancer campaign, which is proudly supported by Centra.